This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
31.381 trillion dollars. That is where we are. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 19th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Today is indeed debt limit day, the aforementioned nearly $32 trillion. And we will get there on the program today in due course. But honestly, there are more immediately pressing economic challenges right now, chief among them, everything in this economy that depends on the cost of money, which is everything. So that is where we begin today, the Federal Reserve and how the guardians of interest rates are thinking about their next move, which will be upon us February the 1st. As Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, a whole lot depends on how the Fed is thinking about that next move.
Whether it's Federal Reserve Board governors or investors on Wall Street, they're all living with the same numbers. And yet, there are differing views on what to do with interest rates. Stephen Blitz is chief U.S. economist at T.S. Lombard.
If they stop too soon, you get more inflation. If they go too long, they create a recession.
Fact is, we don't know if what the Fed has already done has fully shown up yet in the economy. It takes months. Imagine trying to drive a car with a delay in both the gas pedal and the brake. So that's the argument for small rate hikes from here on out. Don Cohn is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and former Fed vice chair.
It gives you time to get feedback from the economy and from the inflation rate about the effects that monetary policy is having.
On the other hand, some central bankers believe rates need to hit at least 5% to snuff out inflation, so speed is less of an issue.
If you're confident in where you're going, there's no reason to go there slowly.
It might appear that the economy is already showing clear signs of slowing down. Retail sales fell in December. Prices actually came down at the wholesale level. But economic indicators are like bricks. You need a few in a row to build anything. Matthew Luzzetti is chief U.S. economist at Deutsche Bank.
Weakening economic activity is a very recent development. It's unclear how persistent that is, and how much weight you put on that will influence what you think should happen with monetary policy.
It's also unclear how much pain the labor market has to suffer before inflation gets under control. A tight labor market contributes to inflation in services, but how big of a deal is that if inflation is already coming down for goods? Chris Varveris is co-head of U.S. economics at S&P Global Market Intelligence.
Because we're unsure of exactly how quickly some of those prices will reverse, we're not really sure how much softness in the labor market we might need to finish the job on inflation.
For now, according to futures markets and the CME FedWatch tool, markets are assuming the Fed will ease up and go the slow route next month. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Yes, but markets today, though, traders were a bit glum. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The financial plumbing specialists who work for Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen are going to have a real busy couple of 4, 5, 6 months moving money around to pay the bills we have already run up now that we've hit the debt limit. And I know what you're thinking, because I'm thinking the same thing. We are doing this again?
Yeah, it's a recurring episode.
Congress has revamped the limit since World War II 100 times.
As long as we're continuing to finance a lot of our budgets with deficit spending, Congress needs to revisit the issue from time to time.
That was Carola Friedman. She studies financial history at Northwestern. Kathleen Day lectures at Johns Hopkins. and Eric Hilt is at Wellesley. They were on this program almost a year and a half ago. That's when that tape is from, November 2021, the last time we all did the debt ceiling dance. Congress did, in fact, raise the debt limit that December to $31.381 trillion, as I've said. And since we are here again, and with a firm belief that history does indeed repeat itself, tell me I'm wrong, we are going to play you part of a piece we did back then about how we got to where we are.
The debt ceiling is a vestige of the time when Congress was much more heavily involved in federal borrowing.
Like how?
Basically, every time that the Treasury needed money, they would get authorized a certain amount for whatever it is that they needed.
They would write legislation for specific bond issues.
A nice example is the construction of the Panama Canal.
A little job connecting the Atlantic and Pacific.
So here's how it worked. In 1902, Congress authorized the Treasury to issue Panama Canal bonds. The money from those bonds could only be used for that one project. Other projects, whatever the government wanted to do, were funded with their own bonds or their own taxes, and Treasury had to keep all those little piles of money separate.
That works when the economy and the projects are relatively simple and they're small.
Then when the U.S. entered World War I...
April 6, 1917.
That is a type of conflict where the financial needs are, first of all, unprecedented and also highly uncertain.
The American forces capture the base of the largest artillery weapon developed during the war.
And so this idea that you could go and specify how much you needed to borrow and you would be authorized for a particular type of security, a certain amount, it just doesn't work.
And so
Congress passed a law granting the Treasury the authority to issue war bonds up to some fixed amount. I think it was $5 billion at the time.
And presto, the first debt ceiling.
Eventually, that evolved into the debt limit that we have now, which is a single overall limit for all federal debt.
And the whole idea is to give the government more, or the Treasury, more flexibility.
That flexibility thing is key here. How much debt the Treasury Department feels it needs to sell to fund government projects, what denomination bonds and bills, and at what maturities. It's Janet Yellen's job to figure that out. And like Kathleen Day said earlier, the cap on how much Treasury can borrow to pay for everything that, again, Congress has already spent has been changed almost 100 times since World War II.
But it hasn't always been done with all the acrimony and political football that we now have.
Okay, this is me back again now in 2023 with this. The U.S. Treasury's market, the bonds and bills and notes we issue to borrow the money to pay for the spending that Congress has already approved, is the biggest and most liquid debt market on the planet. It is literally what the full faith and credit of the United States rests on. Very not good things are going to happen if Republicans in Congress keep to their promise to use the national debt as policy leverage. Amy talked about this yesterday, I think, that the party is over at Party City, it having filed Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. The last couple of years have been rough for the events decoration business, what with the pandemic and all. But there is more to this particular corporate struggle than meets the eye. Marketplace's Matt Levin is on the Noble Gas beat today.
When Kate Luneva launched Wow Balloons in the Dallas-Fort Worth area in 2019, helium wasn't cheap, but at least she could get a full tank from her supplier, starting about 6 months ago.
They started selling half tanks instead of the full tanks because they couldn't get enough helium for everyone.
A full tank now costs Luneva $350. Before the pandemic, it was $195. Luckily, Luneva's business mostly uses regular air to fill their balloons, though helium is available if customers ask for it. And while regular air doesn't loft balloons as high, it's kept her business afloat.
There are definitely a lot of businesses for whom helium arrangements are 100% of their income.
Helium balloons aren't 100% of Party City's income, but they are the big traffic driver, says analyst Carew Martinson at Jefferies.
People come in for a balloon, and they'll at the same time be like, oh, I need party favors. You know, we should get a pinata, too.
Party City started scrambling to find helium last year.
The U.S. Bureau of Land Management plant supplies about 8% of the global helium, went down at the beginning of the year.
That was because of worker safety concerns. Fires and explosions closed other plants around the globe. Commercial helium is typically a byproduct of refining natural gas. But since it's also used for everything from cooling MRI machines to making semiconductors, a helium mining industry is emerging in North America. Phil Kornbluth is a longtime industry consultant.
Price of helium has risen to the point where it can be economically viable to explore for that gas and drill for that gas just for the helium.
Kornbluth says helium prices have just about doubled since 2021. He expects the shortage to ease, but not until 2024. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration released its annual billion-dollar disaster report last week. In all, there were 18 weather and climate disasters last year with price tags in the 10 digits. That includes hurricanes, tornadoes, wildfires, other phenomena as well, made harsher and more unpredictable by a warming planet. The winter storm that hit Buffalo in late December was on that list. It dropped 52 inches of snow, killed dozens of people as well. And it did real damage to the local economy. Johanna Dominguez is one of the small business owners I met when we were in Buffalo last October. She runs a plant shop on Elmwood Avenue. It's called Put a Plant on It. Johanna, good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you.
How is business at Put a Plant on It? Let me ask that first.
Yeah, it's been interesting. We had that record blizzard, which put a huge damper on business for us because that's usually a really big week for us. But interestingly, for January 1st, is 16th sales have been up compared to last year. So,
oh, that's good.
So that's promising.
Yeah. It occurs to me that you have live things in that shop. And even though there is a blizzard of the century outside the door, somebody's got to get in and tend to the plants, right?
Yeah. So usually I actually put on my snowshoes and I'll snowshoe in.
Oh, wow.
But this time I actually couldn't make it to the store for about 3 or 4 days. So thankfully, we didn't lose power at the shop. I lost power for 4 days at home, but at the shop, we only lost power for about 2.5 hours. The birds were fine. The plants were fine. We only lost a few. It could have been a lot worse. So we were very lucky.
Yeah, because we put some pictures up when we came to town, but there are plants all over the place in that shop. There are birds, as we said. You had like a steam thing going. I mean, it's amazing.
Yep.
You only lost a couple.
Yeah, no, it was good. So I'm not sure what percentage we lost, but it was very minor. I'm going to guess probably about 5% of our inventory. But also, we weren't sure if we were able to make it back in the store because, of course, they were predicting a monumental storm. Yeah. But, you know, they always predict a monumental storm. And so we didn't think it'd be that bad.
That's
but
right.
Before we left that day, I talked to my employees and I said, let's make sure in case we can't make it in, water everything that we think will need water in the next 2 or 3 days. So that definitely helped us.
What do you hear from your peer small businesses up and down Elmwood? How did they survive?
I definitely have heard from other business owners that it was a tough holiday season, especially that week in between Christmas and New Year's, because everyone's here spending time with family and they want to come back and they also want to visit the stores and the neighborhoods that they're used to seeing. And we didn't have that this year. And so I'm in a group chat with a bunch of the other business owners, and the other stores on the strip are definitely feeling the fact that we did not have a holiday season.
Yeah. So the first couple of weeks of January was good for you coming out of the storm over a year ago. What are you seeing as you try to plan your 2023? What are you thinking?
We're, again, focusing a lot on our services. We're focusing on partnering with other businesses that have a larger space and doing offsite classrooms now. Those are starting to kind of get really popular. So we partner up with a local brewery that's in a different area. And pop-ups, you never know if they're going to be successful or not. But with a class, there's always a solid attendance fee. So then that's more of a guaranteed income. So I'm trying to push those a little bit more as opposed to a pop-up or something like that, because then I'll know I'll have like 20 participants that are paying $40 to $55 in order to take this class.
Right. Is that a cat, by the way, in the background?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
just checking. Just checking. You know, people are going to go, what is that in the background? What about pricing power and plant prices? They're down, right?
Yeah. So I actually did, looked through my numbers really quick. So we've only been open for 3 years. Yeah. And so the month of December in 2020, we did $65,869. Mm-hmm. In 2021, we made less because the prices have gone down. And then with 2022, December 23rd, which is when the blizzard hit, to the December 31st, it was a huge slump, which was kind of terrible to see. We just did 5,000 just because we lost that week.
Yeah. But that's the name of the game in small business, right? You just got to keep going?
No, totally.
Johanna Dominguez, she runs Put a Plant on It on Elmwood over in Buffalo, New York. Johanna, thanks a lot. It's a good catch up.
No, thank you.
Coming up,
fans cheering and clapping and crying.
Not your run-of-the-mill video game, I'll tell you that. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials off 252 points today, 0.75%, 33,044. The NASDAQ gave up 104 points. That is just shy of 1%, 10,852. The S&P 500 lost 30 points, 0.75%, 38,098. Procter & Gamble reported that while prices were up, sales volumes were down 6%, the biggest quarterly drop in, you know, a good long while. Shares in P&G gave up 0.2% today. The CEO of Uber said today the company is working with automakers to develop electric vehicles optimized for its rideshare and delivery business. A very tough nut to crack. Uber added 0.25%. Bond prices fell. When that happens, the yields go up. The 10-year Treasury note stands at 3.39% today. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. U.S. News and World Report first started ranking colleges in 1983. It now ranks, and this is by no means an exhaustive list, high schools, law schools, and business schools. Since November, though, more than 24 law schools, many of them highly ranked, have said they are not going to participate anymore. And this week, Harvard Medical School said it is withdrawing from the med school rankings. The dean saying, essentially, education is too complicated a product to be ranked numerically. But as Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports, a lot of applicants still pay attention to that numerical ranking, which means a lot of schools do too.
What's happened in the past 2 months could change the role rankings play in applying to schools.
The credibility of U.S. News, certainly their law school rankings, has been badly shaken.
Colin Diver wrote a book called Breaking Ranks. He's also led both Reed College and the University of Pennsylvania Law School. He expects to see more medical schools withdraw from the rankings and potentially undergraduate colleges. That would be a big shift because right now,
the first thing you do is you look at rankings. It's going to take a long time to break that culture.
Part of the challenge is people feel good when they pay for a highly ranked college education, same as when they pay for a highly ranked dishwasher, says Patrick Lorenzo, a counselor at St. Ignatius College Prep, a high school in San Francisco.
It makes us feel better as a consumer and, quote unquote, smarter.
Meanwhile, schools, especially those that don't have household names, have a lot to lose by not submitting data and potentially falling in the rankings, says Angel Perez, who leads the National Association for College Admission Counseling.
Colleges and universities are afraid that families may not consider them if they are not on the list.
U.S. News says it's going to continue to rank schools, whether they submit data or not. Eric Gertler is the company's executive chairman and CEO.
There is sufficient public data for us to continue to do the rankings and provide the service and the journalism that we know is important for these students.
Gertler won't say how much money U.S. News makes from the rankings business, but some applicants aren't looking at them at all, and instead what schools' graduates have achieved. Timothy Fields is the author of a book called The Black Family's Guide to College Admissions. He points to role models like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
You know, he went to Morehouse. You know, Morehouse is a great institution. I went to Morehouse, but it's not in these rankings in the way these other institutions are. And so what does success look like? And success happens at any number of institutions.
Fields says rankings can't capture what it'll really be like for a student to be on campus or what comes next. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
If you get thousands, tens of thousands, really, of people in an arena watching sports, surely profits will follow, yes? Well, generally speaking, yes. Basketball, hockey, and if you swap out an arena for a stadium, baseball and football too, the answer is also yes to profits. Esports, maybe not so much yes, because despite actual esports professional leagues and the aforementioned tens of thousands of people in arenas, sustainable profits are still a couple of keystrokes away in that industry. Kellen Browning wrote about it for the New York Times the other day. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
I need you to set the scene for me. The scene with which you start this article we're going to talk about, it's the League of Legends championship, I guess, in San Francisco.
Yeah, it was a huge event. Obviously, this is the world championship for League of Legends. This is the biggest esport in the world. And there were thousands of fans. They sold out Chase Center where the Warriors play. And it was wild. It was the same kind of atmosphere you might expect at a traditional sports game, fans cheering and clapping and crying when their team lost. So, yeah, very exciting.
And it is literally 50-ish, whatever it is, thousand people sitting in this arena watching teams. I guess the teams are playing in real life and then the spectators are watching on like a jumbotron.
Yeah, exactly. The teams come out, they're introduced, they kind of walk up to this raised platform where their monitors are set up. You know, on the screen, you can see them looking down at the platform, and mm-hmm. then you're watching their characters on the screen, and people are reacting to that the same way they would to, you know, a Steph Curry bucket or something like that.
And yet the NBA makes $1 zillion. And the gist of this article is that while there is probably going to be money in esports, it ain't there yet.
Exactly. There's so much hype for esports. People think it might be the future of entertainment, especially for young people. But a lot of the investors that have gotten into this space thinking that it would quickly become the next NBA, the next NFL in terms of revenue have been a little bit surprised by how long it's taken to start making money off their investments.
And you point out in the piece that, you know, nobody thought it was going to be an overnight success, but it's taking way longer than people thought, than the investors thought. And I guess the first question is, how come?
Yeah, one of the biggest reasons is simply that broadcasting deals in the NFL and the NBA and traditional sports account for a huge proportion of those leagues' revenue, billions and billions of dollars. There were some early projections from some of these esports leagues that they would have similar partnerships with YouTube or Twitch mm-hmm. and get a lot of money that way. Those haven't materialized. And another reason is that unlike in traditional sports leagues where teams are obviously based in Boston, Miami, yeah. San Francisco, and there are teams that build up fan bases in those cities, in many esports like League of Legends, nearly all of the matches are played in one arena in Los Angeles, controlled by the company that operates the game. And that sort of made it difficult to develop fan base appeal and sell jerseys, things like that.
Yeah, well, say more about the companies that have developed the games. And now, I guess they own the leagues too, right?
Right, exactly. And that's put them, in some cases, a bit at odds with the investors, right? Because the investors are looking to make money soon. Whereas these companies, for instance, Riot Games, which owns League of Legends, is okay with operating a league that might be losing money for it in the short term, but is bringing a lot of hype and excitement to the actual game of League of Legends, which it can then make money off of. And so there's been this bit of an uneasy dance as the investors and the companies sort of try to sort out these different priorities.
So what do you think? I mean, is it going to be another? I mean, look, the NBA took, 50 years to get huge. I mean, from George Mikan to Michael Jordan, right? Give or take, whatever. I'm dating myself.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly.
That's decades.
Sure. And that's something that many investors and esports team owners mention in this piece is, you know, hey, we're going to be patient. We're in this for the long haul. We truly believe that, you know, a couple decades from now, this will be the future of entertainment. But I think it's still a ways away. I think there's still some barriers that need to be overcome first.
Kellen Browning covers tech for the New York Times. Totally fascinating article about esports and the leagues and frankly, the business challenge of that sector right now. Kellen, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you.
This final note on the way out today, and I promise we are not going to cover every twist and turn in the debt limit story because it is going to be with us until June easy. But among the many not good things that are going to happen as we get closer to that X date is that government bond yields are going to go up, the interest that the federal government's got to pay on its debt. And when you're financing $31.4 trillion, that debt service adds up in a hurry. Alan Sloan, longtime business journalist, also a longtime friend of this program, wrote in the Washington Post late last year that interest payments on the national debt could total nearly $580 billion this fiscal year. And again, that is just the interest payments without a debt limit crisis. All right, we're out of here. Not, though, without your moment of economic context, of course. I know I said a couple of months ago we were to stop paying attention to this as it normalized after the pandemic, but I just wanted to note here that first-time unemployment claims came in this morning way below best guesses. 190,000 people applied for benefits last week. That is the lowest in 15 weeks. Can you say tight labor market? Sure. I knew you could. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Petra, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Bibawi is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.